Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Chris Tobin and I are talking about cybersecurity. We've got information from experts on how to keep your broadcast station safe, what you can do right now, do today. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the new Ruby console from Lavvo. Intuitive, uncluttered, powerful, yet so refined with AutoMix smart mixing and a context-sensitive user interface. See Lavvo in your future at lavvo.com/worked. By the Telos Alliance and IP Tablet, this one-of-a-kind software virtualizes the monitoring and control of your Fusion or IQ console, Telos and Omnia Gear, and other HTML5-enabled systems. And by BSW, Broadcast Supply Worldwide, where very sporting specials are on right now. Get a great deal on a sports broadcasting package and sound better than ever. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I promise you, I've got that light bulb at the top of the tower. It's in the next room, and I'm still working on it. I'll finish it eventually. We'll be able to plug it in, have it in the background here, and we'll have a 300-millimeter code beacon with some much dimmer lights in it so we can actually see what we're doing and it doesn't steal the show. This is the This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 366th episode, where we talk about, lots of things to do with radio, audio, RF. This week, we're going to talk a little bit about the national EAS test and maybe how it went for you and how it didn't. And before I bring my co-host, Chris Tobin, in, I want to tell you that we don't often use the chat room much here on this show, but we've got it open now. And I'll be monitoring it, and maybe Chris will get a chance to as well. The way that you get to the chat room, now you can watch the show on Facebook Live. You can watch the show also at the GFQ Network's website if you go to gfqlive.tv, gfqlive.tv. That'll bring up the show. They'll bring up the video from a web page, and there's a button there, or you can. The chat room is right there. You can just give yourself a name or stay anonymous, whichever you like, and then you can chat with us in the chat room. And oftentimes, normally, we have guests, and we just don't pay a lot of attention to the chat room, but we'll pay attention to it today. If you've got a question you'd like to ask or something you'd like to tell us about, then feel free to jump into the chat room. You'll see my name in there, Kirk Harnack, and then there are the usual moderators in there. So anyway, there we go. All right. Hey, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. My regular full-time job is I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance. And they make broadcast gear, audio gear for radio and TV stations. So if I have a bias, it would probably go that way. Try to stay unbiased on the show. But I do get excited about technologies that I know about. And another man who is thoroughly biased, it's Chris Tobin. And he is coming to us from the great white north of Canada. Hello, Chris. Welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. Yes, I'm biased at +150 volts. But anyway, it's a great day. Yes, I'm in Canada. I'm at the CCBE, which is known locally as CCBE. But for those of you who don't know it, it's Central Canada Broadcast Engineering Conference, and it's in King's City, Ontario, this year at the Kingsbridge Conference Center. As I was mentioning earlier, it's as you can tell by the scenery behind me. This is not a green screen, blue screen, or a fake set somewhere in the middle of Culver City, but actually in King's City, Ontario. And there was a breeze. The trees are moving. That's not some CGI. So it's actually a really nice place. It's 120 acres of trees and trails. There are some tennis courts. There are a couple of pools, a few ponds. And it's really cool. It's a really fun place. It's meant to help you open your mind to think about stuff, about your business, wherever, whatever you're doing, and think innovatively. They actually have an innovation library. As I mentioned earlier, it's got nice leather seats, sitting tables, coffee, or at night, beverages of all sorts. And it's really cool. We have pictures. I'll have Suncast bring up the pictures in a moment, but that's where I'm at. And it's a very nice 67 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hey, and in fact, if folks want to if folks want to find out about this conference, and I've had the pleasure of going to it, I think 3 times, and I'm going to really try to go back next year, maybe give a paper. But it's a serious engineering conference with serious speakers like you, Chris, and reps from other companies and some radio stations and talking about technologies. And it was held this year. It's at the Kingsbridge Conference Center, as you mentioned. What's the name of the? Where was it held in Barrie, Ontario, before? Right, a little bit north of Toronto.
Yes. Yes, the conference has been going strong for 66 years. I believe this is the 66th year. in the last 2 years has been held here at Kingsbridge. Prior to that, it was the Horseshoe Resort in Barrie, Ontario. Very nice place. Unbelievable facility. They have more than just a few things there. It's a really great place. But they changed it last year to this location. It's about an hour, 45-minute drive from Toronto Pearson Airport. So it makes it much easier. Barrie is about a two-hour drive, so it could be limiting for some that may not be able to make the trek. But this location is really nice, and it's a fun conference. Today's sessions were SBE workshops, and they were, let's see, what were they about again? There was about, IP version 6 and IP network security. Can my network be hacked? So today started the conference. It goes through Saturday night. Sunday morning.
Hey, tell you what, on that subject of broadcast IT network security, let's make sure we hammer on that in just a minute or two after our first commercial, because I want to cover that. We had a great response to that subject at the Ohio Broadcast and Multimedia Technology Conference, which was last week. So let's hit on that. That's been a hot topic. By the way, in case you're interested, you, the listeners, viewers, are interested in the Central Canadian Broadcast Engineers Conference, the website, if you look up CCBE, you'll find quite a number of CCBEs. It's a popular acronym, apparently. It's CCBE.ca, as in Canada. That's their top-level domain. So CCBE.ca, and you'll find out more about that. It's just the Association of Central Canada Broadcast Engineers, Technologists, and Technicians. Good show, and they have wonderful hospitality suites, if you know what I mean. So
yes,
good, nice little, room to room to room, party to party to party. Hey, after the learning's done. So, hey, this week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Lavo, L-A-W-O, also popular in Canada. They're a German company, and hence the spelling. Lav, it's L-A-W-O, like Lavo, but it's pronounced Lavo, lavo.com/ Twert. So when you go to their website, please add the slash twert, and they'll know that you came, at least in part because I suggested it. And not only that, it's one less button to click, because it'll take you right to the Radio On Air page at lavo.com/twert, where you're going to have additional links. You can click and see all about their radio consoles. They have, of course, a great selection of radio consoles. Lavo is known for these great huge consoles at television and live events like the World Cup and the Olympics, the BBC and the CBC and NPR all use them. They have a whole line of consoles, like the brand new Ruby console, where you have this great mix of easy to use functionality from the hardware surface, so your disc jockeys don't get confused, and you have a lot of under the hood stuff available at the touch screen, which you can let the disc jockeys use if they want to, and if they don't want to, great, you the engineer can do it. So that's the Ruby console. But you'll also find the Crystal Clear console. We talked about that quite a bit here on the show. The Crystal console, which is the hardware surface version of the Crystal Clear, the Sapphire and the Sapphire Compact consoles. And then a terrific tool for building software workflows called Vistool, V-I-S-T-O-O-L, Vistool. Lots of information on their website about those different consoles and Vistool. Also, you're going to find out about virtual radio. That's been a hot topic at the IBC and actually at NAB earlier this year, where more companies are developing ways to broadcast with non-traditional control interfaces, typically a touchscreen. But it also may be the fact that you are operating equipment that's miles away from you, maybe in the cloud. And so Lavo is involved with that. Check out their virtual radio page. Routing systems have that. You can route audio just all over the place. Virtual radio in the form of their Relay product. This is a whole radio station in a backpack, basically. That's a pretty cool thing, good concept. And it's worth taking a look at. So, again, lavo.com/twert, and then click on the Relay, the Relay link that's right there on the page. The E is backwards, I guess, because that website was available. And it's cool to call your product that. And, again, there's a direct link to the Ruby console as well. It's a new way of thinking about radio, where physical and on-screen multi-touch controls combine to give your on-air talent a new way to create. There's also videos on there. You'll find Mike Dosh and others doing demonstration videos as to how their equipment works and why they think it's better and why you may think that as well. Lavo.com/twert. We appreciate Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Thanks very much. So Chris Tobin and I are here today. We're shooting the bull about some broadcast ideas and technologies and procedures and techniques and the EAS test that happened here in the U.S. Just yesterday, to see if we can find out how that went. And by the way, I want a quick program note. In upcoming weeks, here are our guests. We've got Kim Sachs. She is the director of engineering for, I believe, iHeart in Denver, Colorado. And in fact, we'll be seeing Kim in a couple of weeks, or a couple, three, 4 weeks, for the National SBE Annual Convention that'll be held in Denver in a few weeks. And also, we're going to have on the show Charles Kinney. He is the director of engineering for Cox Radio in Atlanta. And he's got a very cool liquid-cooled transmitter that we're going to be looking at. I'm going to go live. I'm going to go to the location where it is, videotape an interview, bring it to you. It's going to be very cool. I want to see, you know, pull out a module and watch the water spurt out. Maybe that's not how it works. But anyway, I'm looking forward to that. And then we've got another guy, Jordan Bitz, B-I-T-Z. Jordan Bitz is going to be our guest coming up. Jordan is a big user of audio over IP, and what's unusual, this just proves it works everywhere, he's in a very small market in Idaho. And so he's going to tell us about how a tiny, tiny market, a little station with some volunteers, can use audio over IP. So I'm excited about that. Right now, though, let's get back with Chris Tobin. I'm excited to talk to Chris about, let's talk about IT security. Chris, what did you learn, or what was presented at there at CCBE?
Well, the SB was... It was actually a lot of fun. They went over a lot of basic stuff, and you know, password security methodologies, you know, the common sense stuff, which is actually what I think a lot of times at conferences or webinars on IT security in general they overlook. Everybody goes deep into the technology part of it, you know, and understanding all the various protocols and routing and what you do with this and what type of methodology. And it's like, no, wait a minute, let's basically look at it this way. The human element, the human access, the human assets are usually the weakest of the weakest links in a system we need to talk about. And part of the workshop was talking about what not to do and consider, and to make packs run, the much easier it is for someone to, say, breach the network. And that was one of the takeaways. And I have to say, there's a lot of truth to that, because I've worked at a couple of corporations, broadcast groups, where the IT departments were very savvy and smart about not making things difficult to do, and said, okay, come up with a password that's relatively easy, and here are a few bits of criteria that we have recommend. And then they did all the heavy lifting at the firewalls, in within the routers, within the business unit, physical facilities. One location I worked at, we had it so that each radio station cluster was its own, if you will, island within the corporate WAN. So the corporate WAN, primary access to the internet, right? You have your broadband service coming into the corporation, and from there it was distributed. Facilities, and if you're in a multi-market facility, each market was its own firewalled cluster. So hence, you did have a breach of some sorts in the cluster in Atlanta, and he did it right, the breach would stay there. Yes, it'd be troublesome and dead for the business, but only at that location. Maybe your other 6-5 stations within the group will be impacted, or at least you have.
Hey, Chris, I don't think you've been breached, but there certainly is a lot of breakup in your audio. So we're going to see if we can get reconnected. In the meantime, while Chris is getting reconnected, I'm going to tell you about what we did last week. At the Ohio Broadcast and Multimedia Technology Conference. It used to be called the Ohio Broadcast Engineering Conference, but since multimedia is beginning to involve so many broadcast technologies, they named it to include that as well. So I was very pleased to be able to chair a panel discussion. It was the last thing that we did during the day. It was the last thing, and it was called, let me get the exact name of it here, Practical Cybersecurity for Broadcasters. Practical Cybersecurity for Broadcasters. We had a great panel on this thing. Mike Kelly with EW Scripps was there. Brian Longstreth from iHeartMedia was there. And Ryan Wilkins from Elevated Networks, that's his own company, was there at the Ohio Broadcast and Multimedia Technology Conference. So we came up with a document that, I don't believe that the session was videotaped. So we can't, provide a link to that. But what we can provide you is basically a big outline of the topics that we tried to cover. We couldn't get to everything. And in the show notes of this show, I'm going to put a link to this document. It's just a Google Doc document. One of the things we really wanted people to walk away with, though, and maybe Chris is back online here, jump in if you are, but we wanted engineers. We realized engineers were watching this panel discussion who were involved at different levels of cybersecurity, IT security, involved, just barely involved. Hey, if they can just make a password and a login for a Windows user, okay, great. All the way up to people who are in charge of IT security. And what we wanted people to walk away with from this panel discussion was a sense of, I need to be aware of this. And there's some basic things that I need to do to better secure the network. Practical takeaways is what we were after. Practical takeaways that engineers, whether you're at a kind of a low to medium level like myself, or if you're at a very high level where you really understand this stuff, you might be able to take away some ideas from this too. Of course, some practical takeaways were having different physical or virtual, if you needed to, you could have VLANs, but physical or virtual, different networks for business users, for operations, and for media transport and routing. Operations and media transport and routing might be the same network, at least have two different networks. One for business, the people who are in the sales office, the admin office, the accounting office, the C-suite offices, that's on one network. And then you had operations, and which may include media transport and routing, or maybe that's its own separate network, where these things are better protected, where you don't have, oh, heaven forbid, somebody coming in on the Wi-Fi, maybe a guest. You don't want your guest Wi-Fi on the same network as your on-air automation systems, right? That could be pretty bad. So have these things either physically separate or using VLANs, at least virtually separate. Myself, at my level, I'm not that big. I don't understand VLANs that well. I don't understand, what's going to make it work or not work so well. So I have physical networks, physical different networks for the business and for our operations. Then you also have, of course, the firewall. And we did a lot of talking about firewalls and what's good practice and what's not good practice. By the way, I understand Chris is working to rejoin us on using a different method. So we'll see if he gets through. Firewalls, one way to understand firewall concepts is there's a terrific little, there's lots of tutorials out there. I like a tutorial that's at grc.com. And I'll put the link is in this document that I'll put in the show notes, grc.com/nat/nat.htm. So there's a firewall concept page right there. Learn your firewall's capabilities, because they certainly have different capabilities. Universal plug and play, UPnP, in a word, no, turn that off. And plenty of firewalls, especially consumer ones, have that turned on by default. We really would like to see that turned off. So UPnP, turn it off. You don't need it in business typically. Port forwarding, well, that can be useful, but let's please be very cautious. And I realize that security by obscurity is not truly security, but at least do the following. I mean, don't forward a port that's under port number 10,000, for example. Don't forward one of those directly in. For example, if you've got a VNC machine that has to be on port 5900, or it is on by default 5900, don't externally forward port 5900 to that machine. There are plenty of well-known ports. Don't forward any of them to an internal machine. If you have to, if you absolutely must, and I hope you don't, but if you absolutely must, pick some high port number and let your router do port translation if it needs to. So maybe you pick 59,287 and forward that to a given machine at port 5900 for VNC. Again, I'm not suggesting that that's safe. It's just slightly safer than, well, you don't want to forward port 5900 because that gets tested numerous times a day. Your DMZ, no. If your router offers a DMZ, no. If you have to test something, okay, but never leave the DMZ turned on and stuff connected, in the IP address range of the DMZ. That's for testing and you know, for, it's just, that just opens you wide up. And if you are going to need remote access, which virtually everybody is, use a VPN, especially a VPN with multi-factor authentication. And these certainly are available in the better routers or maybe your own separate VPN solution. But use a VPN for remote access. At our radio stations, that's what we're doing now. I need to use a better protocol. I think right now we're using PPTP, which has kind of been deprecated because it's not entirely secure. But at least we're using that, and I intend to go to IPsec as soon as I can get time to configure that. So VPN for remote access, and that just makes everybody's life better and makes you a whole lot more secure. I understand Chris Tobin is back with us. Chris, are you there, buddy?
Yes, I am. Sorry for that little interruption.
No. So you're on Skype now, which I can see the video's not as good, but at least it's there.
Yeah. I'm not sure what to make of it. Everything seems to be stable. I've been doing this stuff for the last 2 days, but who knows? Yeah. So but Chris, you're right about the remote access. Definitely.
Yeah, we're talking about practical takeaways from this IT security panel. Different physical networks for different things in this. You know, don't let your guest Wi-Fi be on the same network as your automation system. Right. The firewall, understand that, and you know, UPnP, use VPN if you need remote access, and everybody does need remote access typically. Secure your configuration, because what you want to do is reduce your attack surface for critical systems by removing unnecessary services. So don't just, if you're going to use something for a while, go take an assessment. Go assess what your router is exposing to the outside world. And you may very well find, you probably will find, as I do every time I check, which is not often enough, that, hey, we used to use that IP cam and now we don't. Or now we access that with the VPN. So let's get rid of the port forward for that. Look for stuff that you can remove from the router or from the router's functionality, you know, keep as locked down as possible. And certainly, to go back to what we said earlier about separate networks for employees and guests, make sure that a guest that can get on guest Wi-Fi, that they're on a network that just goes to the internet. They don't need access in almost any case to your internal systems. So don't give them access to that. Just put them on a Wi-Fi hotspot that has, you know, so many routers nowadays have available without you having to think about it too hard. Without you having to configure the three router situation, which some people do, they have a guest facility to give you guest access out a physical port or out some built-in Wi-Fi. Chris, do you have some experience with notion of a guest access to the internet?
Oh yes. Part of the project I did this past summer with the Wi-Fi network, we built in two public SSIDs without a password required, and they were totally isolated from the primary network systems and all the other stuff. Worked out very well, but that was done at the router level, done with the wireless management software and switching. So that's where we did it in hardware and did it at the entry point, not some ad hoc setup that some people will try to do. I've also used a product called PF Sense that has the ability to provide you with guest control, which works very nicely. Yep. There's a few others. I mean, that's just the two. That's the one I've used and a couple of others. But do think about it smartly. Assess the situation. Do attack your network from the outside. There are a couple of applications you can use. I've done it. Some of them run on a Linux box. Others do work in Windows. And really look and see what can be done or can't be done in your network. And also, when you're providing remote access for employees, really think about how you go about it. And think of the methodology you're going to use to track people coming and going. Because I have worked with a few folks recently where they had remote access to places they probably shouldn't really needed, but it was given to them once for a project, and then they never had it taken away. And, you know, you're on the road doing stuff, and you've got remote access to parts of a company that you really don't need it where you're located remotely. That's a breach potential. You know, those are things to consider. Yes, there is some heavy lifting. Yes, there's some administration work you have to do to keep your network secure. But think of it this way. How much are you willing to lose when something goes wrong?
You know, if it's going to cost you $20,000 in damages and it's only cost you maybe 6 or 7 hours of your time at $1,000, guess what? You're better off doing the 6 or 7 hours, $1,000 time, whatever it is, and not lose 20 to 50 or more thousands of dollars, because that's what happens. You've got to look at it that way.
Gotcha. Couple other ideas. And by the way, more and more routers have this guest access. And for example, I use a MikroTik router at all my radio stations, at each radio station, and one here. And I have the same model here at my home office, so that I can understand and be up to date on it. I'll update mine first, make sure I understand what the updates do and what additional functionalities there are. Because when I first got these MikroTik routers, they didn't have guest network built in, and they didn't have a wizard to set up a VPN. And frankly, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and I find the VPN setup to be really cryptic. If you look on the internet, you'll find plenty of people explaining this in Russian or Latvian. But I've had some trouble. But when they came out with a VPN wizard, then bam, that works. And now I just need to upgrade it to use IPsec instead of PPTP. So anyway, look to update your router, and especially, routers get updated all the time, because there have been some horrible, horrible flaws in router implementation at the manufacturer level, where, they have done things like copy and paste UPnP functionality into the router code and made a mistake in doing so. There are some routers out there, and there's still some out there, that the UPnP is not only works the way it's supposed to, opening up ports automatically by request of inside stuff, but there's also some that have been implemented backwards onto the WAN port, so that an attacker can easily open up whatever port he wants to the inside and has full access just by sending the right instruction to the right port number at your public IP address. And yes, there are some out there that do that, and I'm sure they haven't all been patched, and some are probably not going to be patched at all, because the manufacturer's not supporting that model anymore. So, by golly, look out for that. We also talked about on your employee network for Wi-Fi, be sure you implement a strong password, and that it accesses the public internet, and that's really it. Except for if you have to make your way into other systems, operations systems, then that's another deal altogether. You may even have another firewall or filter to get to that. And then leverage a content filtering solution to block malicious sites. Now, one site that came up, one way to leverage content filtering was OpenDNS. And there's a free version of OpenDNS. That's what I use here at my house. There's also paid versions of OpenDNS. And you can, one of the real advantages here is you make all of your PCs look to OpenDNS for getting their DNS addresses. So every time you go to a website, it's got to, go look that up. And you can have your router always go to OpenDNS and then, use DHCP for all your internal hosts, your computers. Or you can program each host, each computer to do that. But the point is, don't let Google DNS, which is great, it's fast, but it'll look up anything, even malicious sites, and return them to you. If it's your cable company, your ISP providing your DNS, the attitude for years, and I still believe it's true, is that your cable company doesn't really care about this. The DNS server is a dusty machine in a corner, and as long as it's working, that's okay. And so it's not going to provide you with any security necessarily. So a service like OpenDNS, they do update. And if you have a piece of malware that tries to look up what do I do next .badrussiansite.ru, you get the idea. If it tries to look that up and find an IP address where that is, OpenDNS will say, no, we're not going to let you go there, because we know that that's a bad site. So I'm not saying it's the be-all, end-all in security. It's just one more layer that you can put in there. And plus, if you need to keep your employees from, going to overtly, pornographic sites and that kind of stuff, certainly OpenDNS can get that done for you as well. You can even block things like Facebook, although nowadays with public social media being so important, it's probably not a good idea to block all social media sites. Chris, we're going to go to break here pretty soon. Anything more you want to add about Wi-Fi or routing or other type of security or patching, making sure you're your router's patched and your apps are patched.
Well, yeah, the two things that you touched on that you would talk about, it made me remember. One, if you with your routers and switches, if they're managed switches and routers, make sure you make copies of the configuration files after you've got a configuration that works for you and store it properly. And then make sure that you also consider when you're building out your network and whether the network is physically in one building or one location or it's across the company or the corporation or whatever it is, to try and standardize on the same model or at least the same series of switching and routing. And the reason is so that you can create configuration files, save them, and implement them if you have to redo something. If something goes wrong, you can just flash it back in, sort of like a disk image for your computer. The other thing to consider is with DNS, also bear in mind, most DNS services that are provided by the ISPs or common carriers typically are not well managed, very slow. Lookup timetables are not in order, and you may have what appears to be a bad internet connection, but it's not. It's just the DNS server is very slow to respond to your query. So if you're considering open DNS, that's one of the other reasons to consider it. It's current, up-to-date, and it moves very quickly. And I've been using it a lot on projects and just ad hoc stuff when I'm setting up machines. I just use an open DNS IP address, and people are like, wow, the internet's much faster. Yeah, well, that cable company's DNS server is probably running on an XP, you know, probably a Pentium M processor, maybe, I don't know. But all I did was change where the DNS was pointing, and you're telling me your machine's working faster. What does that tell you? So these are things to consider. Yeah. And again, it goes back to what I said earlier. The human asset element of your operation is very important to understand and watch. And you'd be surprised at things you discover and go, oh, that router we purchased for $6,000 does work. The person at the keyboard is having an issue typing. Got it.
Hey, and as long as we're talking about DNS, I'm a pretty big fan of the Security Now podcast and Steve Gibson. He wrote a Windows – all stuff he writes is Windows. He wrote a Windows program called DNS Benchmark, and it's a small executable. You download it, and you can set it up with – it's set up already. It comes pre-configured with a number of common DNSs, and then you can put in your own ISP's DNS and others if you want to check them out. And this is a program where you configure it, and you just let it run for a while, and it goes and benchmarks really thoroughly over some minutes, maybe a half hour or so, the performance of lots of different DNS servers. And you're exactly right, Chris. Your internet can seem slow, but if really what's slow is, you know, the person looking up the website you want to go to, then yeah, it can seem really slow if those DNS lookups take some time. So yes. DNS Benchmark, I used it here at my home office. And of course, Google's DNS 8.8.8.8 and 8.8.4.4 was pretty fast. It may have been the top of the heap. My own ISP, Comcast Xfinity, was pretty fast. Open DNS was within the top five or six, you know. And then there were plenty more that were way on down the list that took a lot more time. So DNS Benchmark, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So a little Windows program, download it, run it at your location from where you are, and see lots of stats about your DNS and other ones that you might consider using. So cool. Hey, we're going to take a quick time out. And when we come back, Chris, let's talk about authentication and passwords, the new NIST guidelines for passwords that came out within the last few months. And hey, should your employees be put on Chromebooks? Would that be a good thing to do as more of our services get put in the cloud? You know, upsides and downsides to that, but I think there's a lot of up. Maybe we should consider people having Chromebooks. Two of my computers that I use on a pretty regular basis are either a Chromebook or an Android tablet, and I get done most everything except video and audio editing, and that's coming. So anyway, be good to check that out. Hey, our show this week in Radio Tech, it's Kirk and Chris talking about technology. And we're going to get to the EAS test, talk about that in just a few minutes. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends at the Telos Alliance. And I want to talk to you about virtual radio from the Telos Alliance. We've got a webpage up. It's, I'll put that in the show notes. It's success.telosalliance.com/virtual-radio. That's too much to type in. I'll put it in the show notes. But at this webpage, and you're looking at it right now if you're watching the video version of the show, this is where Telos Alliance brings you a lot of information about virtual radio, what a new frontier it is, and what different people, what different broadcasters, what different engineers, what different manufacturers think of virtual radio, because it can mean a lot of things. Now, to me, to Kirk Harnack, the ultimate virtual radio is, if you want to, is have your whole radio station in the cloud. And maybe you've got a flat touchscreen work service, or maybe you've got a traditional-looking console to manipulate your controls and have your microphone and your headphones and so forth. But everything else is off in the cloud, and you're remote controlling it. That is certainly possible, and that may be where people are going in the long run. But in the meantime, there's steps to get there. And one of those steps, for example, is the new Axia IP tablet for virtual radio. Now, the IP tablet's been out for a couple of years now and available easily for about a year. And it was simply an adjunct to an Axia console, to an Element, or to a Fusion console. And it gave the operator more meters, more controls, more convenient control of various things from a tablet environment, either built into the Surface, the Fusion console, or on a stand, or just handheld, you know, on an easel. You could take it around the studio, run your faders up and down, have control, even take phone calls, control your phone calls that way. Well, now the IP tablet has grown up even bigger. Jerome Gehary, who is the developer, the chief developer of the IP tablet, he's in Paris, France. Jerome has now got the IP tablet to where, I mean, it's, as they would say in the movie, it's freaking huge. Now we saw this thing demoed at IBC on a huge Dell touchscreen with a matte finish. So it was very visible. Overhead lights didn't bother at all. You could see it just great. And on this screen, you could design your own screen. So you have faders on there. You have great metering. You have your automation system running right there on the same screen. They happen to have a Zeta automation running there. And then control of your codecs and your phone lines. That's one way that virtual radio is happening. And by the way, this screen doesn't have to be at the radio station. It can be somewhere else. And then you can use, you know, separate codecs, whether they're software or hardware codecs, to get your voice to the station and get your audio coming back so you can listen to it. On this webpage that we'll direct you to in the show notes, Frank Foti has done a short video about virtual radio. His, more specifically, is about virtualizing audio processing. And we've been at TELUS Alliance, been doing that for a year now, too, with the Omnia SST. So that is awfully cool. Hey, then there's what's also cool about virtual radio is you've got third-party developers working on this. So Tom Kalibout from the Netherlands, or maybe from Belgium. Tom was at the IBC show, and I did a video with him about he has written a four-fader mixer control application for, I guess he was using an iPhone. And it just connects by IP back to a TELUS Alliance X node. And you have a mixer with four or five physical inputs, depending on which X node. And you've got buses for program, for monitoring, for headphones, for mix minus. That you can do all that simply with an X node and a program. By the way, Jerome Gehary with IP Tablet had this as well. And beautiful, beautiful touchscreen control of your radio mixer. And then there's real benefits to the idea of virtual radio. You know, if you buy a phone system and you use it once a week, well, my goodness, that's 100 plus hours a week where your investment is not getting used. But what if your call-in talk show is in the cloud? Because that's, I think, where we're heading. And so on the same page, on this web page that I'll direct you to, I got a video with a couple of guys from Germany about this whole notion of off-siting these kind of things. Well, the TELUS Alliance is heavily involved with bringing you virtual radio, and it's one step at a time. But man, we are started. We're on the way, and I hope you like what you see and what you hear. If you want to go to it, I'll say it again, but I'll put it in the show notes: success.telusalliance.com/virtual-radio. And yeah, you're gonna like what you see. Oh, and one more note on that. A couple weeks ago, I got to go to the BBC, and I got to see a local station out in the countryside in Kent, small town, and they had the standard BBC, what's becoming the standard BBC setup with consoles. I mean, it looked like a radio station, like any other station you'd go into. They had two control rooms, and they just flip back and forth. They alternate between the two. It's a talk and news station, and there's no mixing engine there. There's nothing there to mix the different items together. Every piece of audio either comes from that studio and goes to London or Manchester, because they have two sites that are disparate, and audio coming back from their automation comes from both London and Manchester at the same time. And so, they have work surfaces and microphones and headphones, and that's it. And it's just amazing. Then in London, I can't tell you what I saw in London because I'm like under NDA. No pictures. Don't tell anybody. It's kind of proprietary. I say it's proprietary, but you know what? It's off the shelf hardware. It's stuff that you or I can go buy from an industrial hardware computer manufacturer, and it's just amazing. So, all right. That's Virtual Radio. Thanks a lot to the TELUS Alliance for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris, forward, onward. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm still here.
Okay, good. So authentication.
I'm just watching people jog by and ride by.
So I think a big guide was just say no to default passwords. Oh, my God. Think of all the default passwords that we keep hearing about in the news at, let's say, Equifax, right?
Yeah. Yes.
The password was password. Yeah.
Yeah. I have worked with IT departments and IT individuals. And I can assure you that they continue to use the word password for the password and do not make any effort to force it to change. I asked a friend to borrow a laptop. We're working on a project. I said, can we get a laptop for this so I can program these video encoders? And he says, yeah, we got one from the IT department. Here it is. I said, do you know what the password is again? It's locked out. He's like, oh, shoot. No, I don't. Hang on. Let me call him up and find out what the password is. I said, you go do that. And while you're at it, get me a scotch neat because I have a funny feeling I have an idea what the password is. I type in the word password. Password didn't work. I said, oh, this is good. Password 123. Oh, that didn't work. Let me try one more digit. Password 1234. Thank you for logging in. And I'm into the machine. I'm working. I'm already programming his stuff. And I plugged into his network, and the machine got recognized by the network. So I was like, he comes back. He's like, oh, did you find the password? Yes, it's the universal password. I'm so grateful for your IT department. He looked at me. He's like, what? I said, didn't you get that memo? Come on. It's common practice now. So there I am sitting there. I'm setting everything up. He goes, are you on the network as well? I was like, yeah, why? Do I need to log in with credentials? Well, yeah, you're supposed to. You're not an employee. I'm like, yeah, funny thing about that black hat I wear. Sometimes I practice things you shouldn't do. What can I tell you? to your point of authentication and practice and my mentioning earlier, which part of the network do you really need to focus on?
Yeah.
The people side.
This reminds me, and maybe Chris, you've got an idea about this. So if you're a computer user, you can certainly use a password manager like LastPass. And I use LastPass on all my devices, and I really have to remember one password, and it's really strong. And it's ingrained in my head, and someday I'll probably end up changing it, but for now, no, and it's fine. It has a lot of entropy, and I don't have to remember all my other ones. So, but if you're an IT manager, you could use LastPass. You've got to, go do a lot of typing then. It doesn't automatically interact. Like if you have a user call and say, hey, what's my password to get onto the network or into my laptop? Well, that's not going to be in their LastPass because LastPass hasn't started yet if they're at that point. So I guess what I'm asking is, as an IT manager where a password manager like LastPass can't work automatically for you, you can still use it. You've just got more typing to do to look stuff up in secure notes. What do you do? How do you keep track of your different systems' passwords? Because you don't want to make them all the same. I've got a radio station where that's unfortunately a common practice. A lot of the hardware devices have the same password, depending on what era they were installed. What do you do when LastPass isn't really an option for you and you got to have different passwords? Any ideas?
Well, I guess the question I would ask is, who needs access to the passwords that you're talking about that are considered critical? Say, take the environment that I work in with the engineering company from time to time. There's six of us that have access to passwords that are not super critical, but close. Everyone else has a second-level user password that gets them into the same box. So they have, permissioning, what do you call that? The conditional access approach. Yeah. That's something I've done. I did that a couple of years ago. Where was it? We did that at a radio station in a newsroom. Okay, if you can imagine a newsroom, you know, 50 people writing, typing, doing stuff, reporting stories and putting things together and trying to lock down those computers. There was 35 of them. It's not easy. So what we did was we had different levels of access by just using whatever password they chose. So be it, it was tied to a conditional access level, and that's how it works. So, you know, super user, administrator, root, depending on the operating system. There was only a few of us, and those passwords would change on a regular basis. But again, it's a small group and it's controlled. That's an approach to consider. I mean, LastPass and those other password managers are definitely handy. Sometimes I think you're right, though. You could probably get a little messy trying to do it for your, you know, administration stuff and running around and trying to keep track of things. Also, passwords, you know, from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, as well as Steve Gibson at Security Now, you don't have to get crazy, crazy with the entropy and make it 72 digits in order for it to be very secure. The trick is to understand how people try to break it, what they do, and then just have a regular practical approach to securing other parts of the network. If you're just going to assume your password is the best way and that's the only level of security, then no matter what you pick, you'll probably have a problem. There's all kinds of things. I mean, I wish there was one easy way to say it, but there isn't. You know, like I said, I did a network this year, this summer, and we had two public Wi-Fi setups to allow people, and we didn't put a password on it. And we had several folks visiting from other organizations saying, why don't you have a password on your public Wi-Fi? And I said, what's the point? What, I'm going to go issue out a password? Here's your room number. Use this every time. What's the point of that? It's just let them get in. It's got totally locked down, bandwidth limited. Everything about it just allows you pretty much to browse basic web stuff and email. That was it. And if you were to stream video, you're limited to the download speeds. I think we'd set it for 5 megabits down, 3 meg up or 2 up. And guess what? Nobody complained. I checked the stats and we pushed a lot of data through the network. Not one complaint the entire summer. So it works, but you do have to sit and take a real measured approach. And that's what we did. There was three of us. I was the outside contractor, and then the two people who actually worked at the organization. And they were like, what do we do? And I said, try this approach. We did it. It worked. So, you know, you can do it. And I've been to radio stations where they don't do that, and I have gone into the guest network and found my way out. So it's like, you know, it's not easy, but you have to do it.
One of the takeaways we got, or a couple of them here, I'll mention. You can go to a website, haveibeenpwned.com. And in fact, you can subscribe. I don't know if there's a cost or not. Get yourself an alert if your email address has been found in any stolen databases. Have I been pwned, spelled, have I been, pwned.com. I haven't tried this myself. I need to do it. It's a walk away that I said I would do, so I'm going to do it. And you can be alerted if your name and perhaps a password was stolen from one of these databases that keeps getting hacked, whether it's government or private industry or healthcare or Equifax. Of course, passwords should be changed immediately if you suspect the password you used on some site was compromised, especially if it's the same password that you use for company assets. And that's another really good point. Even if you have a high entropy password, if you use the same password at lots of different sites, if it gets stolen from one site, hackers may very well try it for lots of other common sites like Amazon or YouTube your bank site, you know, all the common bank sites, PayPal. Things like that. So that's why you really don't want to use the same password for different sites. And that's why a password manager is so important. You can understand password entropy by going to, again, Steve Gibson's site, grc.com/haystack.htm. And I'll put that in the show notes, grc.com/haystack.htm. And, you know, your password doesn't have to be crazy brutal in order to have a lot of entropy. It really shouldn't be a dictionary word. And you can just add, the reason it's called Haystacks, his webpage is Haystacks, is because you can take some password that you like, and then you can add maybe some dots in front or in back, or some slashes, or just a couple of odd characters in front or back that you know what you're doing, and that adds a lot of entropy to the password. Let's say you've got your favorite 8-character password, but you really want to get 12 characters in there. Well, you can add some characters front and back, or just to the back, or just the front, that make it a lot harder for a computer algorithm to guess what it's going to be. So anyway, that's a good thing there. Also, you mentioned, Chris, the NIST standards. You know, NIST for years, or maybe decades, have been calling for changing your passwords every, you know, whatever, 90 days or every 2 months or twice a year. And they no longer say that that's necessary. And I'm in favor of that. If you've got a great password and you believe it's not ever been, you know, stolen or compromised, then you don't need to change it. And the problem is when you require users to change passwords, they tend to recycle old passwords. And if you don't allow that very often, then they'll just keep making passwords that are a theme, that are variations on a theme. You know, like Kirk Harnack 12, Kirk Harnack 13, Kirk Harnack 14. And then when Kirk Harnack 1 becomes available again, they'll go back to use that. And then it becomes so complicated that they'll start to write them down on a piece of paper and stick it, you know, under the keyboard or on the monitor. And how many times have you gone to an office? I was just in an office yesterday where the password was clearly written on a yellow post-it note and stuck to the side of the monitor. And I'm like, okay, yeah, wow. Yeah, so don't make that crazy. If you require that the password has, you know, every different type of character plus a haiku and some, you know, charade symbols, well, people are going to have to write it down, and that's just no good.
It's true.
Anyway,
it's true.
Yeah, I hate to go on and on about passwords, but you know, there's really a great balance somewhere between stupid simple, like, you know, like monkey or pass 1234, and doing it fairly right, where it does have some entropy and it's, you know, hard to guess. So,
well, you know, on the topic of the passwords, and yes, it's maybe something like, you know, beating a dead horse, so to speak. One thing to remember is that's your first line of defense, right? That's your first level. It's like a security pass at the gate of a military base, right? What's the first level of defense is that you have to identify yourself, authenticate who you are, state your business. So password, your login, and your password are the first two levels of identification. Well, passwords, if you can remember them in a proper manner, why not consider, you know, the short passwords, not as short, but a more easily readable password, say the word evergreen, right? Evergreen, the letter E's could be replaced with the numbers 3. People say, well, that's easy. Everyone knows that. If you're a hacker, that's the first thing you do. That's correct. But then it's evergreen hash and a number and maybe another hash or a dot or two dots. And then before that, maybe put two numbers. And now all of a sudden you've got entropy that will work unless it's a state-sponsored event. And if you're working in an environment where there's state-sponsored events taking effect to get to your information, odds are you probably have a different method of password security and other levels of protection. So we'll just stick with the non-government agencies and the NGOs that we all are and say, hey, the word evergreen could be manipulated with other things around it, so I can remember that, know this, and now I have something that makes sense, and that's my first level of protection. To your point about evergreen number 2, it's 90 days. Evergreen number 3, evergreen number 4, you should have in place in your password system or in your the server system the ability to prevent that from happening. I can tell you I've worked at two corporations where you could not do that, and it prompted you. And what it did was it also alerted the IT department that, hey, somebody's trying to reuse a older version of their password, and then you get an email or a visit and say, hey, here's why we do this. Let me help you find something that makes sense. That in itself can save you a lot of headaches if you don't allow people to reuse, as you pointed out, Kirk, you know, Harnack number 1 after you've gone through Harnack number 12 and 15. So these are the things you have to think about. And you got to sit and look at it and go, hey, wait a minute. What? How do I attack this? It's a multi-tiered approach. I say this because I've worked in Washington, D.C. I've worked in places where I've worked government operations. I get it. And that's how you sort of prevent it. And yeah, do people hack systems? Sure. How many hacks happen from within an organization? How do you prevent that? That's a whole nother level of security you don't want to get into. These can happen. But we're looking at the outside trying to get in. And there's a lot of stuff you could very easily do that makes sense. I mean, in the early days, 2000, 2001, I worked with the guys at AOL on a couple of projects, and they were using the RSA, the little number generator. So when they were on the road and needed to access the network to do their email and any business, they had the RSA generator, the numbers changing. And that was their method of getting in. If you didn't have it, you didn't get anything. You got squat. And if you didn't have any activity on the computer for a certain amount of time, it logged you out automatically. That's something else I do with a lot of my remote access people, is if they're remotely dialing, connecting in. One, I control their access to the network areas. So it's not everything in the network, only maybe what their core responsibilities are. End of story. Second, if there's inactivity for a certain amount of time, and that takes a little practice to figure out your people on the road, what is considered inactive time. Then it logs them out. And you tell them in advance, hey, by the way, if you step away from your computer to go to the bathroom, it's more than 5 minutes, you're coming back to a login screen. Just know that. Don't panic. Yeah. Don't call me. Don't call me and say, hey, my computer's broken. Just say, this is what's happening. Those are levels that can help. Also, if you've got people in your organization that travel, like you and I, Kirk, and you're in hotels on a regular basis, or I'll say public access venues, you're in PAVs, definitely be using VPN. Do not let them use the local connection. I don't care what password you pick, and if you use a one-time pad for your password purposes, no. Just tell them, here's the access, go to this, connect through VPN, we're going to set up a client, whatever, and do it. I have witnessed and read so many papers lately about the stuff these public access places have. It's just scary. It just do that. And also, those of you in the audience that absolutely. No, those in the audience I know right now are going, oh, wait a minute, though. VPN is overhead. I can't deal with the overhead. The overhead, if you have the right equipment, like the router is designed to do VPN, should not be an issue. Okay? That's the problem. If you buy the $110 router / switch / Wi-Fi unit and it has a VPN server built in, I'm pretty sure it doesn't have the horsepower to manage all that plus a VPN tunnel or two. Make sure you get a router, switch, device, mechanism that is designed to do it, and they'll give you the specs. It's in the specs. It'll tell you the throughput during VPN sessions. If you can't find that information, don't bother buying it. I went through this last year with a friend of mine doing some work in the city, and he's like, I don't understand. It's the VPNs. We can't get anything to work right. So we looked up the specs. Ha! The throughput was less than the box offered. And I was like, what's the point of that? So these are things you got to look into. It's a lot of the under the hood back office things, but it makes a difference. And at the end, if you have a router that can handle VPN properly, your folks in the remote field, I mean out in the field, won't even know the difference. They'll feel like they're right there in the office. And that's at the end goal. That's what you want. The user experience has got to be counted in and looked at very carefully.
Hey, so we've got one of our listeners, viewers, is in the chat room right now. And let me just pass along a few bullet points of advice that he provides. You could tie your authentication to OAuth or OpenID, OAuth against Google, Twitter, or Facebook. You can certainly do that. And I'd love to implement this myself as a VPN access solution, WPA2 EAP. Now, that allows you to give unique usernames and passwords to everyone and to each person individually. So that means, like right now, my VPN solution, all my remote users, which at the moment is only 4 people, but if we ever had a problem with one of them and had to let them go, we'd have to change the remote access for everybody. So if you use WPA2 EAP, you can give unique usernames and passwords to everyone. Thanks for that tip. And you can do penetration testing. You can try it yourself, although you're probably not going to be thinking of everything. This IT manager says, I like to go into the guest network just as a quick test and see if I can poke my way to any of the printers and send various messages to the printers. If I can do that, then there's a problem. And speaking of pen testing, everybody in our forum strongly suggested that you don't do this yourself, that you hire a third party to do pen testing or penetration testing. Do it regularly. Make sure you establish the rules of engagement, what type of test they can and can't perform. And the scope should be focused on what concerns you the most, your most critical assets, and providing scenarios as a guideline for the individuals performing the test to determine their strategies. And remember that if you're not clear about what they can and can't do, they might do something that would take you off the air. So you've got to establish some ground rules first. Not that I know what those are, but your pen testing company certainly would. And you've got to establish them to make sure that in their pen testing, they'll find weaknesses, but they won't take you off the air with the weaknesses. You can't do that. We're going to have another a good link in the show notes from FBI.gov. There's a security policy that we'll put in the show notes as well. Thanks very much to GFQ viewer 94304. Hey, Chris, we've got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll have a couple of thoughts and final words about the nationwide EAS test and what you know about what went wrong and what went right and what I know about what went wrong and what went right. That'll be pretty quick. But still, let's get that covered, okay? Our show this week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Supply Worldwide, BSWUSA.com. And it's, hey, we're closing in on the end of their very sporting specials. So if you need to improve your sports remote package, now's the time to do it before the time runs out. They are now shipping the new Comrex Access NX. That's the new wireless remote codec portable package. That it's beautiful, beautiful screen on this thing now. You know, the original Access? Well, this is the new improved version, the Access NX. It has faster processors, automatic error correction, and a convenient, intuitive touchscreen, a lot more. It's shipping right now. It's amazing. I just talked to Tom Hartnett with Comrex at the IBC show, and he's really excited about how well this thing is doing. You can get a three-pack deal on headsets. Now, this is the famous Audio-Technica BPHS-1 headsets. What you do is you get three of them for the price of two. You pay for two, they'll ship you three. It's not a mistake. That's the deal. And it already has installed XLR and quarter-inch connectors. This is the headset that we use on This Week in Radio Tech when we're on the road with a bunch of people in a noisy location, and it works great. The new Comrex Opal IP Audio Gateway. Now, this lets your guests connect to your studio simply with their smartphone and clicking a link. They don't have to install any software. They just need a mic. They can use the mic that's on the phone if they want to, and a browser such as Chrome, Firefox, or Opera. And I understand that the new version of iOS, iOS 11, includes WebRTC functionality built in. So it will work with the Comrex Opal as well. So it's the Opal IP Audio Gateway from Comrex. Check that out with BSW for your low price. Then there's video. I got to mention this. The sports video package from HDV Mixer. You can grow your audience and your revenue with the HDV Mixer sports video package. It seamlessly integrates video from two cameras with lower thirds, graphics, and more while offering live streaming to social media. Contact BSWUSA.com for your special low price. You'll want to give them a call for that. You call BSW at 800-426-8434. They're open, I want to say, like until 9 p.m. Eastern. They're on the West Coast, but they stay there, you know, till like 6 or so. 800-426-8434. Call BSW USA and Broadcast Supply Worldwide. By the way, if you order before 7 o'clock Eastern time, they have this warehouse in the Eastern time zone, Columbus, Ohio. It's just down the street from UPS. And they'll put it in a box and get it to you overnight if you like at BSWUSA.com. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Chris, EAS test. Okay, so real quick, what I heard, I have radio stations from American Samoa to Mississippi. Well, actually, that's where they are, American Samoa and Mississippi. And of all things, the Samoan stations went great. I must say the folks at FEMA have spent a few dollars in getting connectivity we're the LP1 out there, and it works. It absolutely works. They've gone a fair amount of trouble to get that. The other thing, though, is in Mississippi, several of our stations went just fine, but one cluster of stations apparently got the message from CAPS a minute later than they got it over the air from one of the LP1 that we monitor. And so we aired the audio from the LP1, and it was horrible audio. You couldn't hardly make it out. Now, our stations that got the CAPS message first, they aired that, and it was beautiful. The audio was just great. Now, I don't know if there's a setting that we could have had. I thought, you know, whatever comes in first is what gets aired. And CAPS at one cluster of stations did not come in. It did come in, but it came in a minute and 2 seconds later than for the over-the-air. So, Chris, what are your thoughts about that EAS test?
I've been hearing the same thing. I read on PubTech, the public radio bulletin board service, that there seems to be a mixed bag of results, similar to what you just described. Some folks got it perfect, others did not. Oddly enough, though, I think if I read most of the postings correctly, it appeared as though those who received it from their LP1s were having the audio issues, and those who received it from CAPS, it was fine. I haven't finished reading through all. It's the strangest thing. I'm like, wow, that's really weird. But I guess we'll find out in a week or so once the dust settles, so to speak, and people start explaining what they found. But for the most part, it looks like it went out like it was supposed to. So the question just becomes, if the stations with the audio quality issues, maybe the question is, what methodology are they using to receive it? Maybe something needs to be considered there. I don't know. It's just seems kind of odd. Because the last test, last year, I think nobody really complained of that type of problem. I think it was more of people didn't have the codes right or something to that effect.
Well, I think it worked better, but it seems like we want to figure out a way to make sure that CAPS goes on the air first, or is what goes on the air. So maybe we receive it from the LP1 and hold that back and see what happens with CAPS. And I don't know why some of our stations got their CAPS right away. I know there's polling involved, and I don't know how much delay there might be in the polling of, you know, from one Sage or other brand unit to the next, checking the state's CAPS server. So I'm a little ignorant on that, but that's what it appears to be. I'm sure we'll get a full debriefing in a few days or weeks after everybody gets their forms filed, and we'll see what happens.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, before I forget, I've got to mention, because I found out last night while I was here, when I arrived here at the CCBE, for those of you in Canada, you know who these two people are. For those of you who don't know, they're business folks. It's Oakwood Broadcast and GS Broadcast Technical Services. They sell and support provide services for broadcasters here in Canada.
Yeah.
And the people that run it are Richard and Sarah. And Richard and I were talking about some stuff, and Broadcast Bionics came up in the conversation. Talked about video and how the two of us both agree that a lot of broadcasters in radio are missing the point behind using video and telling a story and not just sticking a camera in the room and getting the shot of your jock. And it's like, what's the point? And then we got talking, and I said, well, you know, we talk about these things. Kirk and I talk about this all the time, and we show these different videos and from time to time. And Richard goes, oh, yeah, I don't always get to watch. I just listen to it when I'm in the bathroom or I'm running around. I was like, that's okay. The fact is, you're remembered and you're listening. You hear it. Tells me something's right. So for those of you who are panicked that you're not getting the video, don't worry. Richard assures me that the audio only still gets the story across. I had to do that because every time I see him, he always apologizes like, oh, well, you know, I didn't get to watch it, but I do hear it. I'm like, okay, that's good. So I just want to make sure everyone's aware of the fact that both versions do get the story across. Sometimes a little livelier if you watch the video, but it's okay. So I just had to throw that out there just for the fun of it. And there's a few folks I'm going to be seeing over the next couple of days. It's going to be an interesting time. And I will say that a lot of them do support us here at TWRT as well. So I have had a few folks. Awesome. Yeah, last night, walked into the lobby, and I don't know who this person was. And he said hello to me. He goes, it's great. I love watching you and Kirk and the stories you talk about. And some of the topics actually make me think. And I'm going, that's great. And you are, so you have me at a disadvantage. He's just a local broadcaster.
Exactly.
He's actually, funny thing is, he's an owner of a radio group in some part of Canada, in the outer reaches. I'll say outside, it's suburban. I'll call it suburban community. Very sizable community. I looked it up. So I was like, well, thank you very much for that. So I just wanted to, I'm not going to say names. I'll get anybody in trouble. So thank you for all the support. And those of you out there know who I'm talking about. And we do have a gentleman. Oh, I hope I have this right. In New Zealand, is it? Does IT work, loves watching what we do. He does IT along with some broadcasters, and apparently we've talked about things that's given him ideas to do stuff. I'm not going to say his name, but he knows who he is. He's emailed me, and I just want to thank that person again, too. So I got to throw these out. I get these emails from time to time. I totally forget to get it, you know, squeeze them in.
Well, I'm flattered when people say they watch the show, and that's really very cool. So thanks for keeping us up on that. And hey, if you viewers, listeners, if you see me or Chris or any of our guests out there, if you just want to say hi on Facebook, TWRT has a page on Facebook. I check that regularly. We also have a Twitter presence. I don't check that regularly. I'm sorry. Just I forget to. But your feedback is very welcome. And thanks a lot to EGF Tech Man in the chat room, who is the one who supplied some tips. We're going to put his tips in the show notes as well. Today's show notes going to be good. Tell your friends about This Week in Radio Tech, and the show notes can be found at gfqnetwork.com, also at thisweekinradiotech.com. You'll find them at both those places with the full show descriptions with the show notes. Chris, thanks so much. I appreciate you making the effort there from Canada, just out in what, Kingsbridge, Canada?
Well, it's King's City, Ontario. Kingsbridge Conference Center is where I'm located. So, yeah, you got to be careful. When you say Kingsbridge, there is another location. It's called Kingsbridge. That's not it. It's King's City, Ontario. And it's Kingsbridge Conference Center, and it's a really nice facility. So if you're an organization that here in Canada especially, but you could be in the States, and you want a place to get your folks to and retreat from, so, you know, like a manager's retreat, whatever you want to call it, I will say this is definitely a place to consider because there's a lot of opportunity just to free your mind and get things going and get some real thinking and the juices is happening. And then, the pictures. We didn't get the show to pictures. We'll do it next week. Pictures together. We'll do a photo gallery next week of the before and after of CCBE. And Tom King from Kintronics, who I had dinner with last night, who's here. One of the things we talked about was shows like this are great because it's not only just the products you get to see, but you get to actually talk to people who want use them, to their manufacturer's rep, in an environment or a setting that is very comfortable and you're not pressured. And I've been coming here now 7 years, and I have to tell you, the information, the stories I get really do help and have helped me on many projects. So if you're in Canada and you're nearby and you're able to drive here or get here next year, consider it. It's well worth it. It's a lot of fun. And if you know Ron Paley and Darren and Rob Parsons and the gang from Paley Broadcast, then you know what I'm talking about. It's a good time.
Good deal. Good deal. Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate all your effort in this. And I should mention that coming up next week, our guest is Jordan Bitz, small town broadcaster, big, big audio over IP. And Jordan's going to let us know how that works for him. And he's using a number of different technologies there. Also, Kim Sachs has agreed to be our guest on an upcoming show. She will tell you about what it's like to maybe high heels in a muddy field. She really works hard at her engineering job there. And Charles Kinney from Cox in Atlanta is going to give us a tour of a water-cooled or liquid-cooled transmitter. So I can't wait for that. That's all coming up in some future episodes. Plus, we'll be doing a live show from Madison, Wisconsin. I'll mention this next week. But in 2 weeks from now, our show is probably going to be on, I forget if it's Tuesday or Wednesday. Whatever day it is, it's going to be a different day here. Let me look it up real quick. We don't have a show on Thursday the 12th. It'll be on Tuesday the 10th at the same time. So 2 weeks from today, it'll actually be the show will have been done 2 days before. So anyway, got a little change coming up to accommodate everybody's schedule. Thanks a lot to Suncast, our producer. Thanks to Andrew Zarian, and thanks to all of our sponsors. Please patronize them. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.